God says goes. And he gave Canaan, as it was then called, to Abraham's descendants, which they took possession of in Joshua's day. And although after more than 400 years of monarchy, the kingdom, they were ousted, and then returned for another 400 to 500 years, largely as underlings under other conquerors, and again, following the crucifixion of their Messiah, were driven out for something like 1800 years, and only returned as a nation over something like 40 years ago. It is still their land by divine decree. Forever, God said to Abraham, forever. And there's nothing, for instance, that the Quran can do about that. There is only this one proviso, of course. Until they acknowledge their Redeemer, Jesus Christ, they will still suffer for his blood, which they said would be on their heads and on that of their children. Hence, their seat in Palestine, as we call it, is far from easy, nor will it ever be easy until they acknowledge their Messiah as their king. Democracy? Democracy? What's that? Theocracy. Rule by God. So, despite their authoritative departure from Babylon with loads of good things, and curiously enough, the blessings of the heathen conqueror Cyrus, who had swallowed up almost the whole of the Middle East as the Persian emperor, they returned, did these Jews, to find themselves not very welcome. And just as in Georgia today, and in many other parts of the Soviet Empire, decrees have gone out about freedom of one kind or another, especially religious, but locally, there is still very much entrenched communistic ideology and practice, and KGB opposition to openness. And so, as subsequent history will unfold, the people then entrenched in Judea and Samaria were exceedingly appalled at the return of the Jews, and they thought they had seen and heard the last of them. And it must have been one of these alien people's great satisfactions for these 70 years following the downfall of Israel and Judah, who, as Rahab said, had gone from Egypt to take over Canaan, and in David and Solomon's day practically ruled the Middle East, or at least were in the ascendant there. So that local kings and queens, like the Queen of Sheba, came to see the glory of Solomon's kingdom. I say, it must have been one of these alien people's greatest satisfactions that Israel and the Jews were no more in the land. But now, these pestiferous Jews were back again to set up their altar and temple and kingdom utterly odious to all the heathens. And it was a stroke of divine genius that the pagan world of that day would never have envisaged, any more than tyrant Sedan would ever have imagined that he would live to see the day when he would have to protest vociferously on Baghdad television till he was sick at heart. Huge falsehoods about the truth of his downfall. These Jews were back, and the whole Palestinian situation was radically upset. For if these obnoxious Jews rose again, by Cyrus's permission especially, and became a ruling power, as they had been these hundreds of years ago, their distinctive religion might dominate more than the Eastern Mediterranean. But to come to the text, there is a question whether it was despite the fear of these resident peoples, as the NIV puts it, or because of their fear of them, as the New English Bible puts it, that the Jews began to build their altar in the open air, their kind of glasnost. If it was because the Jews feared the people dwelling in the land, then that suggests that they felt so utterly vulnerable and unprotected by their God, having had the most marvelous departure from Babylon and being wonderfully protected from all kinds of hostile peoples on the way, that their convoy arrived altogether safely and intact. I say, if it was because the Jews feared these people, then that suggests that they felt so utterly vulnerable and unprotected by their God that in sheer terror that their Lord would desert them and they would be in dire trouble from the people of the land if they didn't at once set up an altar and sacrifice to their Lord in haste, that they did so in panic, which is so utterly ridiculous as to be laughable. So I believe the NIV has it right that despite their fear of those snarling peoples threatening them all around because of their return, they felt so grateful to their God for bringing them safely back home that at the very soonest possible moment they must sacrifice to him out of sheer gratitude and devotion on the spot on which sacrifice had been made by their fathers for centuries. It was no panic measure. Their God and ours doesn't work that way. The ways of his wisdom, says the word, are pleasant ways, and all its paths are peace. He would never harass his children that way, especially never in the midst of such a traumatic experience as their arrival back in devastated Jerusalem after so long a time. I am astonished that because we do not have a clear enough distinction in our minds between the ways of God and the ways of the devil, we get them mixed up constantly and far oftener attribute Satan's work to God than we are aware of. I must say that again. I am astonished that because we do not have a clear enough distinction in our minds between the ways of God and the ways of the devil, we get them mixed up and far oftener attribute Satan's work to God than we are aware of. God is a spirit. Yes, but so also is the devil. But the vast difference between the two is that although we may often wrongly identify the one with the other, the difference for those with spiritual discernment, the difference is as vast as the difference between heaven and hell. The one spirit is the creator. The other is a mere created spirit. The one is the master. The other a cringing but hostile underling, who, because he was completely frustrated by God and utterly condemned and defeated by God, he hates him with an undying hatred and wants to harm him all he can. But the devil can't touch the Almighty himself, nor his son, but gets at his children, who, because of their unawareness of his deceptive machinations, are far too vulnerable. I think this must be my theme. During, Lent, and Sunday mornings the radio preachers are preaching their last sermon. What would be their last sermon? I think that if I had one sermon to preach, I hope it would have a very great deal about God, but I hope it wouldn't ignore his enemy. This is the burden of my heart, that the enemy might be exposed to us all constantly. We mix them up. God is good, thoroughly and impenetrably good. He doesn't do nasty things to the children he loves. These all come from the other fellow. Will we get this into our heads? Whatever God does to the wicked, the unrepentant wicked, banishing them to hell, he doesn't do nasty things to his children. I doubt if we really believe that as deeply as we ought, especially at times when we're afraid and something goes wrong and we say, oh, where is God? What's God doing? Why does he allow? Did you see these Iraqi prisoners who, in their pathetic pleading on their knees and their hands clasped, seem to expect that the Allied soldiers would abuse them, if not shoot them on the spot? One British soldier kept saying to a panic-stricken soul in a paroxysm of fear, it's all right, it's all right. The creature couldn't believe that he would be treated humanely. Saddam had made them believe the Allied soldiers were devils. But who were the devils? Ask the Kuwaitis that. But you see, we are too often like that with our God. Because Is this part of the reason? Because of our guilt, which we refuse to get rid of. For all the blood of Jesus, we see our God as a taskmaster and as the punisher in chief of our lives. That's a travesty. You'll never be a good Christian with that attitude to your God. That's why legalism is so deadly in the Christian religion. Deadly and deadening. Legalism has done more harm in Scotland through the centuries than can be told. He's not a taskmaster, a punisher in chief of his people. Yes, if we are deliberately wicked and wantonly go astray, he can be seemingly hard, although he can be mercifully patient, even with the thoroughly bad. But you see, often in our ignorance, and possibly not being particularly naughty at all, we attribute to our God hardness and mercilessness, which is as foreign to his mind and heart as heaven is to hell. It was wonderful, wasn't it, verses 4 to 6, that in the open air they instituted all their chief sacrifices and ceremonies. They chose, or the time was chosen for them, a wonderful month to commence the ritual service. Now, you can read all about the three main festivals of the seventh month in Leviticus chapter 23, verses 23 to 44. On the first day, the Feast of Trumpets for praise. On the tenth day, the Day of Atonement, the most solemn ceremony of the whole year, when the Jews mourn their sins. And from the 15th of the month, for 8 days, the great rejoicing feast of tabernacles or booths to commemorate their dwelling in tents in the wilderness, and how God preserved them all the way through the desert to Canaan. All that went on, although the foundations of the new temple were not yet laid. Suffice it to set up the altar and commence sacrificing, and let their enemies see that nothing would frustrate them from doing so, which was the outward badge that they were very, very different from other nations and would maintain their distinctiveness above all. This is what I was saying this morning about these, comparing these other religions, Islam and Buddhism and all the others, even Judaism. The Christian faith is absolutely distinctive and stands apart. Neither the great verse for this, if you're arguing with people or they're arguing with you, is Acts 4 and 12. Neither is there salvation in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must die, in the Greek, whereby we must be saved. They were called to be different. and different they would be, though the people of the land went mad. And they almost did, as we would see in the book of Nehemiah. So, to the building of the foundations. Under the supreme instructions of Cyrus of Persia, they were free, these Jews, to travel as far as Tyre and Sidon for cedar logs in exchange for other commodities, food and drink and oil, just as Solomon had done. And you can see that in 2 Chronicles 2, 8 to 10. 2 Chronicles 2, 8 to 10, to be shipped to Joppa and taken all the way up the Shephelah, that is the foothills, to Jerusalem. And within the few months, to the second month of the second year, the month Solomon's temple was actually started, 1 Kings 6 and 1, they were ready to commence laying the foundations. This kind of work takes long. We estimated that the rebuilding of our spire might commence this month of March. But we were learning on Wednesday at the annual meeting from our brother Albert that it may be May or even into June before we get a start. There is so much preparatory work to be done, including choosing a quarry for stone to match the old stone. So all the families of the Levites in particular got busy. And the day came when the priests, in their vestments and with trumpets and cymbals, were ready for the praise festival with which the rebuilding was to be dedicated. All according to the book. I mean the Psalter. And according to the order of praise which had been arranged centuries before by David, that master of music and poetry, and to be followed closely by the devout priests and Levite musicians. Look at the dedication of Solomon's temple in 2 Chronicles 5 and 11. 2 Chronicles 5 and 11. The priests then withdrew from the holy place. All the priests who were there had consecrated themselves regardless of their divisions. All the Levites who were musicians, and you see these names heading some of the Psalms, Asaph, Heman, Jeduthun, and their sons and relatives, stood on the east side of the altar, dressed in fine linen and playing cymbals, harps, and lyres. They were accompanied by 120 priests sounding trumpets. 120. If these were ram's horns, the din. Talk about pop groups. The trumpeters and singers joined in unison as with one voice to give praise and thanks to the Lord. And I think if there had been any walls there, they would have been demolished acoustically, don't you think? Accompanied by trumpets, cymbals, and other instruments, they raised their voices in praise to the Lord and sang, He is good, His love endures forever. Then the temple of the Lord was filled with a cloud, and the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the temple of God. Oh, do you think such a cloud of holy smoke might fill our temple when the work is completed here, as it may be in 2 years? That kind of thing was visible then, but not now. Invisible, but palpable. Better felt than dealt with the eyes. The Holy Spirit presses in upon us, and we do not see him, and we do not hear him, but oh, the power of the Holy Spirit, this power that we are praying is going to come down in on Pittodrie at the end of May and the beginning of June. That's what we're praying for, the power of the Spirit of God to overshadow the people and drive souls to Christ. But what was the moaning about which tended to disturb the praise at the laying of the foundations? Ah, well, you know, it's only a year or so since we looked at the prophecy of Haggai on Sunday evenings. Do you remember that? And in the second chapter, we read in the first verses, Haggai, third last book of the Old Testament, Haggai chapter 2, verse 1, on the 21st day of the seventh month again, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Speak to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people, ask them, who of you is left who saw this house in its former glory? How does it look to you now? Does it not seem to you like nothing? That's what they were thinking. But now, says the prophet, be strong, O Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all you people of the land, declares the Lord, and work, for I am with you, declares the Lord Almighty. This is what I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt. And my spirit, we're talking about him, aren't we? My spirit remains among you. Do not fear. Now, that was 16 years later than here. And according to Ezra 6 and 15, it was 4 years after that that the temple was actually completed. So you see, on this day in our chapter, some looked back to the past and mourned, and some looked forward and rejoiced. Now, which do you do? Do you have sympathy with the old folk who long for the old days? Maybe sometimes not when the minister recalls what happened in Union Street 60 and 65 years ago. Well, never mind your old days, old folks. Look at the Jews. What were they mourning about? The old days, apart from the short glory of David and Solomon's days, and, say, glorious days like that of good King Jehoshaphat and Hezekiah and Josiah, apart from that, what had they to look back to but idolatry and adultery? all mixed up together, which is the record of the monarchy for over 400 years. Read it in the Samuels and in the Kings and in the Chronicles. That was why they had been taken captive to Babylon. It was God's punishment for their disloyalty to him. Were they weeping for these old days? These old sinful days? There were people here in my first days who longed for what I would call the bad old days, when this congregation was virtually a secular club. And a dying club at that. Because undoubtedly, although there was a camaraderie about the remnant that was here, they were dying. And it couldn't have survived. And wouldn't have survived, this remnant in this building, 40 how many years ago, if God hadn't stepped in and sent some of us here to reclaim the church and the building for Christ. No, no, whatever the past has held for us in sacred and precious memories, nothing that belonged to God in the past is lost. That's the great thing. Now let's think about that. Nothing that belonged to God in the past is lost. It is all gathered up and is treasure laid up in heaven. Nothing is lost. Why then should we go back to the past? Should we go back, as sometimes, dear Lord, some of us have been tempted to do, should we go back to dear Tom Swanson's emaciated body and not forward to his glorious resurrection body? We are only going back to earthly dregs, not the spiritual fruit, when there was any. That is not lost. You don't think you would need to visit the vestry and see an oil painting there to understand what I'm saying now. You don't think the faithful work of James Kidd in the old church up the road, where he baptized my great grandfather in 1805. You don't think that the faithful work of James Kidd, or the work of Walter McGilvery, whose memorial is in the vestibule and you see it every time you come in, or the faithful work of Mr. Mitchell, a great scholar, and Dr. Robert Forgan, you don't think at all that work that these men have wrought in that church there and in this one here is lost? Do you? Never. The wailing, which was as loud as the praising, was a sheer disgrace. No cause for it in the world. Now I'll tell you why. Israel, through all her long career in the land, was an idolatrous Israel. That's what we were learning this morning, wasn't it? That's why she had to be removed from the land. Whereas the remnant of the remnant of the Jews who had presently returned to Jerusalem from Babylon had one thing removed from their systems, that the earlier Jews, apart from a few godly prophets, never had. And that was idolatry. The Jews were never idolatrous after Babylon. Babylon cured that. Jews never again as a people were idolatrous. They had had enough of it in Babylon. Sickened of it forever. And that's come right down to the present day. And I was illustrating this from Marc Chagall to the children the other Sunday morning. Don't go into that again. My younger sister once worked for a little time in a sweet shop. She said it was for fun. And they told her that she could eat as many sweets as she liked. And she did. Until she was soon sick of sweets and never ate another for a long, long time. That's what Babylon did for the Jews. It sickened them of the sin of idolatry. So the praising Lot were looking forward to a much better life than the mourning and moaning Lot had ever had. For the Lord had drained something away from them that made them far better Jews than their forefathers. Far better. And you see, the very thing which, if I may say this, the very thing which has made me so unpopular with many thousands who have passed through this church during the years that I have been here and have gone away. The one thing that has made the ministry and me so unpopular with many, and there are thousands of them all over the world, and many of them in Aberdeen tonight, is that we were determined that this place was to be a place of prayer and worship and Bible study and nothing else. And we've learned that. I've been through many days in the Salvation Army when long before the charismatics took up tambourines and drums and cymbals, etc., we had them. I've been through all that. And I've been through the clubby kind of congregation too, where pie suppers and entertainment of one kind or another was rife. No. This place. I was speaking to James, driving home, was it at lunchtime? About the first time I went into the church hall and the vestry and the ashtrays were everywhere. This place is for prayer and worship and Bible study, and that's supposed to give the correct tone, you know, to the rest of our lives, so that your life outside on Monday to Saturday will be all the different for your being here and taking part in this worship and absorbing the truth on Sunday. It's all that you should be different on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. This is the stamp, the hallmark of true silver. I sometimes see a bit of the antiques program on Sunday afternoons if my preparation is done by then, and I'm impressed by the experts interpreting the hallmarks on the silver and the gold objects they show, or the signatures of the craftsmen who wrought works of art. That's the hallmark. Have you a hallmark? Could people turn you around a little and say, look, You see, he's real. She's genuine. Her life on Jesus Christ. And although she doesn't go around singing about him at her work, her life sings. He doesn't keep obtruding his faith at every opportune or inopportune moment. But his life speaks. That's it. The life to speak. And it will only speak if it is built up on God's most holy word. I'm very burdened sometimes when older people or middle-aged people or even younger than that who have a good many years of experience of life and in their own profession or vocation begin to grow cold. I think it's one of the saddest things of all, and it must be, because the word is not going home through mind and emotion and conscience very particularly and will. And people get tired of it. Get tired of Jesus and fellowship with him and doing his will. Still, I think there are many. I don't know what's going to happen to them when they die. They must be the Lord's. I think they'll be embarrassed when they see him. But they seem to grow tired of Jesus. Isn't that awful? God help us.